Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. You're tuned to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, December 4th. There's a big vote ahead at the Honolulu City Council next week at issue whether or not to tax owners of vacant housing units. We look at what a new Trump administration with Republican control over both houses of Congress might mean for climate change funding. Will there be efforts to claw back money earmarked for green energy projects as promised on the campaign trail? We hear more about what could come in South Korea following an unexpected martial law declaration and quick reversal. What lies ahead for that country's president, now on shaky ground? And is technology helping or hurting? If computers and phones are now in the hands of our students, why aren't our test scores better? This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Next time you're driving around Kaka'ako at night, look up at all the new high-rise towers. You'll see that many of them are mostly dark, very few lights on, and you wonder, where are all the people? Could that be the solution to our affordable housing crisis? Well, a week from today, the Honolulu City Council takes up Bill 46, which supporters hope can help free up inventory and build affordable housing units. That bill is also known as the Empty House Tax Bill. Here's a sample of public testimony from the most recent committee meeting.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Albany Cote. I'm a senior at UH Manoa. I've been working with, alongside my classmates, to focus on passing this bill. This bill is important, and it's important right now. So many people, while statistics are really important, about cost, that is a really important part to consider. Real people are experiencing real issues with housing right now. And that's why we need to pass this bill as soon as possible so that we can start feeling the impacts of it as soon as possible. This bill needs to be comprehensive and robust enough to actually do the work it was intended to do when it was created. If it's not, then we will have instated a new bill that is not going to be effective in the way that it really needs to be. We have a decision to make by either prioritizing families, local Hawaiian families who are living here now and spending money here on our economy, or we can prioritize the people who own a home here but do not actually live on island. Thank you.
Opposition to the bill worried that it was a too broad brush in its definitions.
Aloha, everyone. My name is William Roll. I am opposed to Bill 46 in its current form. A home does not need to be a residence in order to have significant community value. Many Kanaka and local families, including some of those in my family, will be punished if this bill passes in its current form. Some of their properties are used for traditional practices and house sacred sites like ahu made out of heiau stones and gardens for la'aulapa'au Hawaiian healing. My great-grandfather was a Lava'i'a on the windward side. His work saving Hawaiian fish ponds was recognized by the City and Council of Honolulu in the 90s. I follow in his footsteps. I'm a published marine biologist. I have discovered and named new Hawaiian species while working at UH Manoa. For this work, I make less money than an assistant manager at a McDonald's. I will not be able to perpetuate his legacy, the legacy of my family, or my stewardship of marine life if this bill passes in its current form. Our properties are used for teaching and conservation, but not living in. The proposed taxes for sites used for non-residential purposes would be more than my salary. This bill is so well-intended, but it should be modified to ensure no local people are inadvertently hurt. Please stay this bill and amend it to exclude Hawaiian residents from requiring to apply for exemptions. Mahalo.
Lawmakers also heard testimony from Andy Kawano, the director of the city's budget, Department of Budget and Fiscal Services. He urged lawmakers to hold off on the measure until a report from Ernst & Young is released.
I respectfully ask council members to slow down and not go to third reading until we have a report back from the consultants on the feasibility of the bill. My concern is due to council members, you know, listening to feedback from the public, the number of exemptions that have been added to the bill that I believe could extremely water down the amount of homes that are, quote, empty based on what, you know, we can actually validate. and what can actually be supported. So I suggest strongly that we allow this study to at least get through phase one so we can get feedback from a third party who has been involved in, you know, other programs that are effectively working. I'm speaking about the Vancouver program in Canada specifically. There is concern of cost of the program. You know, to properly administer a program with, you know, a number of exemptions approaching 20 is going to be extremely challenging. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to need staff to review, evaluate, and then enforce the law such that we're sure that the exemptions that are being processed are valid and accurate.
And this morning we talked to Council Chair Tommy Waters, who announced new amendments to the bill. The tweaks are in an effort to garner support for its passage and to address some of those concerns that we just heard. Here's Waters about the urgency to do something.
We have the highest rent in the nation, the highest rent in the nation, higher than New York, higher than San Francisco, Los Angeles. And by the way, I'm getting these statistics from a UHERO study called the 2024 Housing Factbook. A young man named Justin Tindall wrote this, and I encourage all your listeners, if they have time, to check out the UHERO 2024 Housing Factbook, which says we have the highest rent in the nation. We also have a median home price of $1.1 million. Think about it. If you want to buy a home for $1.1 million, you typically have to come up with 20% down payment. That's $220,000 cash, right? Or even if you're a first-time home buyer, you have to come up with 5%. That's $55,000 cash. Who has that? That's ridiculous. Plus, I'm the fifth of six kids, all born and raised here in Honolulu. And five of my siblings moved away to the mainland. You know, according to this 2024 Housing Facts book again, 67,000 people left Kauai in 2022. 67,000 people. That's our friends, family, neighbors that can't afford to live here. So we are in a housing crisis. That's why I'm thinking, got to be bold, we've got to be decisive. That's why I wrote Bill 46.
And you are proposing some changes prior to the final vote next week.
Absolutely. So I also want to just make it clear that we want to encourage outside investors to be active members of our community. And doing so means to either rent it out to a local family or sell it to a local family or pay more in taxes, right? We're talking about outside investors who come here, buy homes, oftentimes for cash, and they just let it sit because they know in a year or two or three, the value is going to go up and they make money. And at what cost? It's at cost to our local families and our future because we're unable to own or buy a home because of these outside investors. And the idea really is, again, to encourage them to either rent it out to a local family or sell it or pay more in taxes and we take that money and use it to build more affordable housing or to get local families into housing. You know, the city has a down payment loan assistance program with 0% interest. I'd love to put some more money in that so that we can help families get into a home.
When you introduced this bill, there was some pushback. Talk about the changes that you're proposing.
Okay, well, first thing, people were concerned that it was unconstitutional. So we created an empty homes tax classification, which we believe after doing our legal research that that's going to solve the problem. Second thing is we wanted to make sure that it was more understandable. So I want to make it clear. If you have a homeowner's exemption, meaning you live in your home, this bill doesn't apply to you. If you rent your home to someone, this bill doesn't apply to you. If you are in probate court, you know, oftentimes it happens where families are in dispute over, you know, their home. That doesn't apply to you. But I think the biggest thing that we did was, you know, oftentimes families have a second home, like a beach home in Mokulaia, for example. right? That they don't always live there, but they use on weekends and whatnot. Well, we made an exemption for them. If you have a first home with a homeowner's exemption and you have a second home that's empty, well, this bill doesn't apply to you. And that came right from the community. I remember testimony from a Mr. Kuroda out in Kapolei who testified. And we heard him and we listened to him. And we got a lot of emails and phone calls from people who were really concerned about this. And we're listening to them. And we made amendments to accommodate those folks.
Do you think this is going to make it more palatable to get the votes that you need to pass next week?
I sure hope so. I think it's going to be a close call. When you have a crisis like we do, you know, you got to be bold and decisive. And I'm hoping my council will follow me and Radian Cordero, our budget chair, in supporting this bill, because it really, really is going to make a difference. It's not going to be the silver bullet that solves all the problems, but it's just one important tool to help us solve this problem that we're currently facing.
Under one of the exemptions that you're proposing, if there are properties that are licensed and being used as residential homes for seniors, you know, or a halfway house, you know, those would not be considered under this?
That's correct. That's correct. If you, as another example, if you're giving medical care to someone and you're not staying in your own home because of that, this bill doesn't apply to you. If you're currently undergoing medical care and you can't be staying at home or you're living in a care home, then that doesn't apply to you either. So really, really thoroughly went through this to figure out how we can actually target the outside investor who's just parking their home here, making money. You know, when I was walking door to door, oftentimes people would complain about these condos in Kaka'ako that are just sitting there vacant with no lights on. Well, this bill addresses that. Legally, we cannot say that a foreigner or out-of-stater cannot buy a home here. We can't say that. I think in the legislature, they tried to pass a bill that didn't pass. But we can charge them a little bit more in property taxes if you're going to leave your home vacant. And then the idea really, again, is to take the revenue that's generated and use that to help local families get into a home.
And these tweaks that you're making, I mean, there are about a dozen of them, but how complicated is that going to administer? And are you going to need additional staff to, you know, roll this out? Is it going to be worth it, you think?
Yeah, definitely. So the city has hired Ernst & Young to do a study to figure out how to implement this. Well, I met with the Ernst & Young folks, and they hired a group that implemented this tax in a number of other jurisdictions. And they're here to help Honolulu implement this tax. The good news is that I made the implementation date and the tax year 2027. That gives the administration, 3 years to figure out how to implement this and to educate the public on how this works. So, yeah, definitely. And I think it's going to work. And we're giving them enough time to do it right. And initially, we proposed taking a portion of the revenue and giving it to Budget and Fiscal Services in order to hire more staff. But I made the commitment to the Director of Budget and Fiscal Services, Andy Kawano, that in the upcoming budget cycle, we'll put in extra money for that department to hire more staff to do this. And just looking at other jurisdictions that have implemented this, according to the Ernst & Young folks, you know, it's totally doable. And based on the size of our county, our city and county, we'll probably need about 4 or 5 extra staff people, which is totally doable.
And you got the support from the Star Advertiser's editorial team for passage of this bill. How does the mayor feel about this? Have you chatted with him?
I have. I don't want to speak for the mayor, though. But in our brief discussions about the idea of an empty homes tax, he seemed very supportive. But again, the proof is in the pudding. We got to make sure we get this right, make sure the legislation is right, We've gone through Corporation Council, the city's attorneys, to review this to make sure that it's legal. And so far, so good.
And so as far as the timetable for, you know, actual rollout for this, if the council approves it and the mayor signs it?
The implementation will occur in the tax year 2027. Tax year 2027. So there is a good amount of time for implementation and education to occur.
All right. Anything else you want to let people know? Any final thoughts?
Again, we're in a housing crisis, and we can't just sit on our hands and hope that the problem goes away. We can't build our way out of this. You know, since I've been on the council, we've approved over 8,000 affordable units, but only a fraction of those have been built. It takes time to build. So we got over 18,000 empty homes in Honolulu, and this is a quick way to get folks or to provide housing for local folks. We're going to continue to approve and build affordable housing, but it's another way to provide housing is by filling these empty homes. But, you know, Bill 46 gives us hope. Gives us, in my mind, gives us hope and gives us a fighting chance. You know, again, it's bold. It's decisive. People are going to be uncomfortable with it. But other jurisdictions have done it, and it works. So let's take a chance.
Let's take a chance. That was Honolulu City Council Chair Tommy Waters, who says this is his third try to get a tax on empty housing units. Council members take up Bill 46 next Wednesday. For links to the amendments proposed by Waters, head to the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
In Morocco, climate change is making the drought worse, so the country needs new ways to maintain its water supply. One solution, tap into seawater.
Now we are in this site of desalination station, because we think that in Morocco, this is the solution.
What it takes to climate-proof Morocco's waterways, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Nohea Gallery at Kahala Mall, with gift ideas from Hawaii's artists, including handcrafted jewelry, local woodwork, original art, and custom prints. NoheaGallery.com.
President-elect Donald Trump has promised to reduce federal funding when he takes office. Among the funding that could be impacted, climate and clean energy initiatives needed in our state. HPR's Energy and Climate Change reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us now to discuss the potential impacts. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so, you know, we're talking a lot of money here, aren't we?
Yeah, quite a bit of money. So, specifically, Trump, who has denied the existence of climate change on the campaign trail, he took aim at the Inflation Reduction Act, and that's the largest climate bill in the world. So there's billions of dollars in that bill that are meant to go towards climate and clean energy initiatives across the country, including in Hawaii. So we're supposed to get a good chunk of that money, some of it which is going to come through the Hawaii State Energy Office, for instance. Since January 2023, they've been awarded almost $75 million in total federal funding, and they have another $70 million in the pipeline that they're trying to get confirmed before Trump is inaugurated in mid-January. And a lot of that money comes from the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And the money in the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act like the Inflation Reduction Act, also has money that's supposed to go towards initiatives reducing fossil fuel use, specifically in the transportation sector.
So is that money vulnerable?
When I spoke to Mark Glick, who heads up the State Energy Office, he said that they are working to make sure all of the funds that they received are in line for, or have received, are safe. So the best way to do that, and we've heard this from the congressional delegation when we spoke with them last week about what is vulnerable when Trump takes office, is to make sure that those funds are spent. But second to that, Glick said that those funds will be safer when they are contractually obligated. Here's what that means.
So they're set aside in funds under essentially an agreement or a contract to the recipient. And in many cases, once they become obligated or they're in those places, these fund accounts, that we have permission to spend on that. So you have this complicated set of circumstances where you have a project underway, you've hired contractors, you've signed contracts because you've been given permission to proceed. So typically those kinds of efforts are not touched because that involves all kinds of very serious legal challenges that would be improper for meddling in that. We feel like once funds have been obligated, that they're locked in. And it's going to be very difficult to claw back.
Yeah, you've got concerns about, you know, breach of contract, right?
Right. That's what you really want, is that contract or agreement in hand, something that is legally defensible if this were to go to court. And that idea was also supported by attorney Martin Lockman. He's with the Columbia Law School's Sabin Center for Climate Change Law.
Once a grant agreement is signed, once a contract is signed, that becomes binding, and that then becomes a kind of legally defensible right that that organization has. However, if money has not been deployed, if a recipient of that money has not yet been selected, the incoming Trump administration would have a lot more ability to slow roll or halt deployment of IRA funds.
And is the money that the Energy Office is in line for, is that already, buttoned down?
So when I spoke to Mark Litt, he said that they're working vigorously to have about $100 million in funds from both the Inflation Reduction Act and the Jobs Act obligated by mid-January. The Jobs Act is a little bit further along. That was passed a year before the Inflation Reduction Act, and so there's just more time to get that money passed through than the Inflation Reduction Act. But there are other ways that Trump can take aim at the IRA. So aside from unobligated or unspent funds, Lockman said that one of the parts of the Inflation Reduction Act that is most vulnerable is its provisions for tax credits for things like electric vehicle purchases. The Treasury Secretary could rewrite or revoke some of those provisions, and Lockman thinks that could basically undermine the Inflation Reduction Act as a whole.
The Inflation Reduction Act appropriates more than $142 billion to carry out activities designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and protect against the impacts of climate change. Alongside that, the Inflation Reduction Act has enormous tax benefits and tax programs designed to encourage private investment in climate solutions. When the IRA was passed, those tax benefits were estimated to be worth about $400 billion. But because they've been so popular and because we've seen enormous private sector investment in climate solutions, and private individual uptake of those tax benefits, current estimates suggest that those tax credits might be worth up to $1.2 trillion. So there's a really enormous amounts of money going towards climate solutions that the Trump administration is directly threatening. Those tax credits are encouraging the development of American manufacturing capacity to build battery factories, to build EVs in the United States to take advantage of those tax credits. And those are enormous, enormous capital investments being made today on the expectation that those tax credits will be around tomorrow. So any action by the Trump administration to inject uncertainty into whether these tax credits will be around really, really jeopardizes not just climate action, but the economic benefits of the IRA as a whole.
And, you know, we have seen a lot of the state agencies go out and buy EVs, right? Electric vehicles. The Department of Transportation has, I think it was like 50 Tesla Model 3s out there running around on the tarmac. You know, we've seen DLNR, you know, I think even the city and county, right, with the buses. So a big push to, I guess, you know, buy those buses and encumber the funds.
Yeah, Trump has not been friendly towards the electric vehicle industry at large. And his inner circle has been particularly critical of the Inflation Reduction Act. So, for instance, his nominee for Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has called the IRA a doomsday machine for the budget. And he's the person who would be able to rewrite or revoke these tax credits. And Trump at large wants to make big budget cuts, right? He's put billionaire Elon Musk in charge of an effort to reduce federal spending by $500 billion annually. And so if they're trying to recoup some funds, the IRA's tax credits could be one place that they're looking to cut. But when you go beyond the ambitions of Trump's cabinet, a lot of experts aren't sure that Trump has the political will of his party to put big portions of the IRA on the chopping block, including Mark Lick.
The truth of the matter is, even with tax credits, there's a lot of red states that really benefit from what are truly large renewable energy infrastructure projects in the hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes in the billions of dollars. I'm not sure the new administration wants to be behind killing large infrastructure projects.
Yeah, it'd be real interesting to see what happens. I mean, you know, Mr. Musk is there, and EVs are obviously a big part of his business. Yeah, so we'll just have to see what happens.
Right, and when I spoke with Martin Lockman, he said that there are things that states can do, and they should do them yesterday. The first, of course, is get those funds obligated. The second, he said, is make sure that when you have obligated funds that you as a state are in, you are agreeing and abiding by all of the terms of your contract, because that could be a vulnerability in possible court cases. But the other thing he said is, okay, if you don't have federal funds to support your climate initiatives, what other steps can you take? Where can the state take action without these federal dollars to keep yourself and your government on track with the goals that you've set in order to reduce fossil fuels and fight climate change?
Yeah, and we've been hearing, you know, that whole thing of hurry up and encumber these funds, you know, before the end of the year. But whether the reality is they can actually do that is something else.
Right. And that is something that the Hawaii State Energy Office says that they're really working on. And they are trying to have about $140 million under contract in federal funds by mid-January.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote about how potential federal funding cuts could impact clean energy initiatives in Hawaii.
Saturday night on The Real Deal. More songs and recordings from 1924. Music of 100 years ago. And a lot of the songs are still in circulation today. I'm Seth Marco. Join me on HPR 1 from 8 to 10 for The Real Deal.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
The stunning turn of events in South Korea yesterday still has many people reeling and wondering what just happened here and what happens going forward. Well, a declaration of martial law and then a quick reversal does not bode well for the president of the Republic of Korea. We talked to Rob York, director for regional affairs of the local think tank Pacific Forum, about the political drama that unfolded while many of us were sleeping on this side of the Pacific Ocean.
I'd say that this was a surprise to most people. Yoon Suk-yeol has always had relatively low approval ratings, and he was facing a couple years worth of investigations into his conduct into that of his wife. So he faced 2 years of that, and he seems to have tried to make a gamble to resolve the problem and seemingly has failed and only hastened his decline.
Well, what do you think is going to happen next? Judging from the briefings that we saw from the military, from the Pentagon, they're very tight-lipped, playing very close to the chest about what they knew.
Because I suspect they didn't know about this in advance. I don't think that this is something they would have anticipated happening. Yoon Suk-yeol, as I said, has had very low approval ratings. And the way it unfolded with the military seizing the National Assembly but not really stopping opposition politicians from occupying it and casting the vote that they did to end martial law suggests that this was not planned well in advance.
What else do you think we should be on the lookout for in the coming days and weeks?
Yoon Suk-yeol will almost certainly face impeachment hearings over this and will almost certainly face a vote on his impeachment due to this. Opposition politicians are already talking about drafting such legislation. And given that the members of Yoon Suk-yeol's own party voted against his declaration of martial law, I would say that his chances of surviving that are far worse than they would have been before today. South Korea has a history of this very kind of thing. Yoon Suk-yeol's declaration of martial law actually included rhetoric that past military dictators have used on anti-communist forces, anti-state activities, and so on. It seems as though conservatives in South Korea have had a hard time shaking the legacy of military first politics, but it appears that the rest of the country does not feel the same way about those military coups that took place. The citizenry were very active, very quick to respond and to take to the streets in response to this. And there's video footage of them actually helping opposition politician members get into the National Assembly. And yeah, they're already protesting and demanding that he be impeached. So I think you are going to see a very quick move to impeach him over this thing that has taken place here. As far as what that means for the broader region, I don't expect North Korea to try to take advantage of this just because they are occupied elsewhere. So this is probably not going to be a situation where the security of the region is at risk at the moment. But this demonstrates that the U.S.'s reliance on Yoon Suk-yeol in order to bolster its relations and bolster its position in East Asia was flawed. And they are going to have to start engaging opposition politicians more on this.
Yeah, it just seems very fragile right now.
Well, it also demonstrates the resilience of South Korean democracy. This was something that was commonplace in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but it's pretty clear that the South Korean public has moved on from that period, even if certain politicians have not.
Well, I was reading somewhere that this is like the 10th time that martial law has ever been declared in Korea.
The precise number of times it's been declared, I could not tell you. I just know that the last time it was declared was following Park Chung-hee's assassination in 1979. So it has been quite a while since this sort of thing was attempted.
And is it your sense that, if he is made to step down, that he'll be prosecuted?
Yeah, it seems to be what the public is demanding. There were already investigations into him and his wife over corruption, and so this will only accelerate that. And the declaration of martial law under pretexts that appear quite flimsy could lead to legal charges in and of itself. I would say that what has struck me the most is how quickly the Korean public responded to this and how they refuse to accept this sort of thing taking place again. They're very protective of their democracy and of their right to vote and so on. The other thing that really struck me is that Yoon had championed very much close relations with the United States and also building the trilateral with the United States and Japan. That was really the only accomplishment that he could point to and say that he had made steady progress on in the time that he has been president. And this is definitely a blow to such efforts.
And then, you know, your thought that North Korea won't try and take advantage of this weakness or instability. I mean, you said they're preoccupied elsewhere, Ukraine, I guess, with all their troops helping out in that dispute.
North Korea has, of course, sent troops to Ukraine. And past instability that has taken place in South Korea has not been something that the North has used as an opportunity to act in a provocative manner, such as the impeachment of Park Geun-hye in 2016, and you know, past constitutional crises such as Noh Moo-hyun's impeachment in 2005. I could go on. Basically, these kinds of politically unstable events do not necessarily translate into North Korea seeking to provoke even a small-scale conflict. I would not expect that to take place.
You know, and I'm just curious, you know, as I was Googling on the internet, I did not know that, you know, you could subscribe to alerts on bases over there. And I am just curious, you know, to find out if the U.S. troops over there and the dependents that are living overseas, if they got any kind of high alert than what it's normally at.
The Pentagon spokesperson said that there were no changes in terms of the U.S. military posture, whether or not there were any alerts specific to the U.S. troops. I couldn't tell you at this time. I do know that the U.S. Embassy put out an alert overnight stating that martial law had been declared, but the whole situation came and went so quickly that there wasn't time for them to recommend specific steps to U.S. nationals living in South Korea. It's definitely worth keeping your eye on specific areas that could turn into flashpoints, you know, the South China Sea, the Philippines and China, their standoff continues. There's also, you know, there's the Taiwan Strait. There's definitely consternation, I'm sure, from the PRC over Lai Ching-te's visit to Hawaii and elsewhere. And I'm sure that that could lead to certain actions taken by the PRC, such as military exercises in Taiwanese waters, a blockade, rehearsal for a blockade, things like that. That's been customary whenever high-ranking Taiwanese officials interact with people that the PRC thinks that they should not.
Anything else you think would be important to underscore just as we sit and wait?
If you have family in Korea, they're probably going to be fine. So the situation has come and gone. So now that it looks like the military has stood down and Yoon Suk-yeol has stood down, you can expect your family members to be safe. If you have investments in Korea, you can probably expect a degree of volatility in the stock market and in the currency at the moment. Whether that will endure is much harder to say, but the won has already shown some effects from this move.
Well, when was the last time you were there?
In early October. There was no sign of anything like this taking place. Like I said earlier, Yoon Suk-yeol has been facing impeachment inquiries for some time, and it looks like rather than simply tolerate that for the next 2.5 years while he did the boring work of trying to shore up the U.S.-Korea-Japan trilateral, he tried to make a decisive move and did not count on how little institutional support he had for that.
That was Pacific Forum's Rob Young, who actually traveled to South Korea 3 times this year. He was talking to us about the dramatic declaration of martial law by the president of South Korea yesterday and the quick reversal by parliament.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii Foundation. Its 4UH for Hawaii campaign connects donors with UH to fuel innovation and entrepreneurship across the islands. UHFoundation.org.
About 40 million Americans have left churches and other religious institutions in the last 25 years, but the reasons why may be a lot more boring than you'd expect.
Most people have left for really pedestrian reasons, like I moved, attendance was inconvenient, or say, family change.
So what does that say about the importance of faith in America? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Integrating technology into education has always been something that schools have had to balance between what they can afford and what will really help students learn. So does educational technology or edtech actually help? Well, HPR's contributing editor Neil Milner is back for our biweekly segment, The Long View. Good morning.
Good morning.
So does high tech really mean high scores?
High tech here that I'm talking about and the way the people writing about this talk about means using technology, generally social media, computers, and the like, on one-on-one relationships. And the surprising to some extent and sad definitely answer is it does not work. That according to all kinds of research done in all kinds of different places and summarized by a neuroscientist and an educator named Jared Horvath, this appears in some work that Jonathan Haidt has been doing, and you can see it, it's cited. Frequent users do a lot worse. Frequent users of ed tech do a lot worse on most learning outcomes than if you don't have ed tech. The ed tech does not narrow the gap between, let's say, higher income, higher socioeconomic status, and lower. Online courses lower academic achievement compared to in-person courses. Countries have begun to move away from ed tech, including a lot of the countries that we look for toward for educational reform, like some of the Scandinavian countries, and that the way tech works best is as a supplement to a person who's a really good teacher. So if you're a really good teacher and you use ed tech as a supplement, this is very disappointing in lots of ways, and I'll get back to that later by talking a bit about schools in Hawaii and what this suggests. So there's a couple things you have to understand about the reasons for this, one of which is that when Horvath looks at all of this research, he says there's all kinds of research that says, including computers, that if you use them, you did better than you did before. Well, he said, think of it this way. Almost any intervention in education does better than no intervention. But if you use a standard that he determines, and it's a fair one, that says you need really to have an improvement of this certain amount in order to continue to improve, if you use that standard, then by that standard, the ed tech is simply not working. And the reason is really interesting. The reason has to do with brain science. He said, here's the deal. When you're using technology in a classroom, or let's say in a classroom, but someone is watching it remotely, that's another possibility here. What you're doing is competing with the brain for space in order to absorb that technology. He said, if you look at the amount of time that students spend on a computer or the like, it's only a very, very small fraction of that amount of time that's spent on the learning process that we're talking about here. The rest of the time is spread out. Well, you know what the rest of the time is. It's social media. It's all the other stuff like that. The brain can't multitask that well. It has to do with nanosecond sessions. So if you're sitting, I always think about students sitting in class and not paying attention to what they're supposed to be using it for. But even if you are, if your skill to learn, I don't know, something about the state of Georgia If that's the skill that you need there is not the same skill that you're using on the computer 95% of the time. So it loses that sort of aspect too, and that seems to be a pretty good complaint.
Well, you know, there's that line, right? Multitasking makes you stupid, and if your capacity is not there to really absorb and
especially if you're trying to learn a musical instrument, right, and you're spending only 5% of your time actually playing that musical instrument, you're not going to do so well on that musical instrument. Take it from me, because I tried that when I was a kid. So that's the case. And now if you think about this in terms of the context of schools in Hawaii, there's been two recent pieces. I cite one of them in Civil Beat. This is where the schools in Hawaii stand. We're talking public schools here right now. Their scores on reading comprehension and math comprehension are sort of flatlined at about 53-54% of the students read at the level that they're supposed to be. That's not great. It's not bad. They haven't changed. They did better in COVID than a lot of other schools around the country that really dropped, but they didn't do that well. Now they're facing a situation in which they got all this money to deal with school improvement as a result of COVID. There's a couple things. One, they're not sure what worked, because they used all this money in different ways. They claim they're going to be doing a study on how it works. We don't know if that's the case. The more important thing is that we don't know at this stage how much money they're going to be able to get to make up for this when the federal money runs out and it goes to the state. That's one thing. The other thing that just came out a couple of days ago is there's a kindergarten preparation test that's given to three-year-olds around the state. There's about one-third, I think the number is, of the three-year-olds or four-year-olds getting ready to go to kindergarten aren't ready to go into kindergarten. And the ratio is the ratio is much worse in lower income areas like Waianae than it is in Hawaii Kai. So there you have it. You got all of these pressures to come up with something that works better. And it's just an example of how you become attracted to the quick fix that EdTech uses, and combine that with the fact that they had to use it during COVID. It's been very tempted to go in that direction to look for a quick fix. It turns out that quick fix is not very quick at all.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, this is a global look, right? It's
yes,
not just
absolutely.
Here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Does everybody have access to these computers?
Well, even if they do, I mean, it turns out that a lot of places did a pretty good job of getting access to computers. Not enough, in the sense that during COVID, it took more than just access. Some places didn't have access and so on. But even if you have them, it doesn't mean that it's going to accomplish what you accomplish. To me, there's a couple of fundamental things here. One of which is how hard it is to teach. How hard it is to teach well, and how oversimplified people who criticize teachers are. And the other thing is that it seems as if these issues are about pedagogy, not about the curriculum. It's about pedagogy. As Haworth points out, he said, sure, every kid should learn how to use a computer. In this day and age, you should have courses that teach how to use computers, although... As I remember in my granddaughter's case, when she got a new, she picked it up at the door while we were talking, you know, a little tablet. And I said, so how long do you think it's going to take you to set it up? She said, I just set it up. I opened the box and, you know.
You blinked.
Yeah, she blinked in because they, yeah. So there is that. But it doesn't seem to be any way to get around the fact that the best teaching, which is hard to develop, hard to cultivate, and even hard to measure at times, seems to be still the best way to go about things, that you can teach computer science as a course, which is valuable, but the use of EdTech in the classroom has been significantly overrated in its effect.
Yeah, it's interesting. The other day I was appalled because I got a thing on my phone that said I spent 8 hours on this device, and I was like, yikes.
I mean, the number that the kids will spend, not kids, but adolescents and older, they'll spend seven hours a day
yeah,
this stuff.
I know. It's addicting. I'm addicted. But thank you so much, Neil.
Not me. Okay. Take care.
Yeah. All right. We've been talking to our contributing editor, Neil Milner, and we'll have links to the EdTech articles he referenced on the conversation page of our website after the show. We now go to this week's Manu Minute and the song of the white-rumped Shama. Thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for their recordings. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
If you live on Kauai or Oahu, there's a good chance you've seen or heard the white-rumped Shama. They measure about 10 inches from the tip of their bill to the end of their very long tail, and really stand out both in their plumage and in their song. The males have a beautiful glossy black back, chestnut orange chest, white rump, and a particularly long black and white tail that flicks up and down when agitated. Females look similar, but their colors are less vibrant. The series of melodious trills and flute-like whistles that make up the male's song when he's trying to attract a female can often be heard year-round. The beauty of these songs is one of the reasons white-rumped Shama are declining in much of their native habitat across Southeast Asia, with birdsong competitions becoming increasingly popular in many areas across that region. They're one of the most sought-after birds, with the best singers bringing big prize money to their often poor owners. White-rumped Shama were introduced to Kauai in 1931, Oahu in 1940, and they've recently been reported and seem to be increasing on both Molokai and Maui. While many people still call them Shama thrush, they're actually members of the Old World flycatcher family. They live on year-round territories in mostly non-native forest and lower elevation habitats, where they consume a mix of introduced fruits and insects. They do sometimes make it into our native forests, where they likely spread a variety of weeds and compete for resources with some of our much rarer native birds. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering nature tours on Hawaii Island with adventures including swimming in private waterfalls, Mauna Kea stargazing, and exploring active volcanoes. More at hawaii-forest.com.
Well, we are all POW now. Up tomorrow, a Hawaiian Airlines worker is calling for changes to the company's long-standing tattoo policy. She's being terminated for violations of that policy. Got feedback for us? Leave it on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.